time for hour number two of the Bible study, the Ask the Pastor Hour. You can call in with questions and comments at 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our guest in this hour, good friend of ours, somebody we haven't spoken to for quite a while. I got to find out if it's permissible for me to call him Dave or not. Diane writes Dave. I think it should be David. Pastor David Andrus, Executive Director of Lutheran Blind Mission. Can I call you Dave? David?
You may call me Dave.
Can I call? Okay.
In fact, if you call me David, I'll think, uh-oh, what did I do wrong?
Anybody who's an executive director, it seems to me, should be David. But Diane's got Dave Andrus written down here. So
yeah.
I guess you and she are on that level of familiarity that I haven't achieved yet.
Well, maybe someday.
Now, you're in charge of Lutheran Blind Mission. You yourself are blind. You also are an ordained man, a pastor in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. What's going on with Lutheran Blind Mission these days?
We are, as we started the new year, we were are in the process of opening up about 6 new outreach centers around the United States. It's taken a lot of our time and energy.
What is an outreach center for Lutheran Blind Mission?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. An outreach center. What is an outreach center? We have found that the majority of those who are blind and visually impaired don't come to church. Some of them are Christian, although I think probably two-thirds of the people who are blind and visually impaired, and there are 12 million in the U.S., it's 4% of any population, are not Christian. They understand that they went blind. They know that it's a problem because the world, in a sense, creates the problem for them. In our fast-paced, mobile, video screen world, it can be difficult. And that just impacts upon their life, the fact that they're different. And God did this, and they get angry at God. And then they hear some bad things of or make false conclusions that God did this because he's angry at them or he's punishing them. So an outreach center, when we find one person who's blind or visually impaired who loves the Lord and wants to reach others, we connect them to a church because so often they are not. And then we go in and we train both the blind person and the sighted volunteers of how to do an outreach ministry. And the outreach center is really a place of a neutral place. It's not a church per se, but a place where you can talk about God, faith, to come to some grips and understanding that God isn't angry. He hasn't punished us, but he loves us through Jesus.
So what does it take to open up 6 new centers? Is that a very difficult thing to do? Do you have all kinds of federal and state regulations that you have to comply with? Or is it pretty simple?
It is simple in the sense of guidelines, federal and state regulations. We always do them in a church. We tried once or twice at a different site, a firehouse and a university, and it didn't work because people didn't have any ownership. It was too far removed from the church conversation. In fact, I was writing an email about a half hour ago that we try very hard not to have church talk, and though we do deal with the struggles of theology, the theology that we bring there is very simple, that God loves, he cares, and he's gone out of his way to show and demonstrate that in Jesus by his death and resurrection. We don't talk about baptism, communion. That's a church discussion, and if people go, I want to learn more about church, well, then that's a conversation that moves out of the outreach center to somewhere else. So to start an outreach center, it can be easy, although the steps are a challenge for us because we want to make sure people are trained and have a right understanding of what we're trying to do. Because if people go into this thinking, hey, I'm going to help blind people come to church, they'll know that very quickly. You're only after me to get my butt in your pew and then you'll pilfer my pocket and trying to get money from me, and I don't want that because that's the institutional church. That's the institutional church that says that God's angry at me, and they'll never come back again. So we set an environment of where it's safe to talk about things of faith as it relates to their blindness.
The six that you are opening, are they the first six, or do you have others that you've already established?
We've opened 67 already.
67?
Mm-hmm.
All over the country?
All over the country. Several have closed. We've been doing this now for 10 years. And the several that have closed, well, I mentioned two. One was a firehouse, one was a university. One, the gentleman did a great job, but he said, at 72, I'm just too feeble, and I'm not up to it anymore. So we had to close just simply because of his age. So several reasons. We have 52 that are active and open right now.
Yep. So when the executive director for Lutheran Blind Mission surveys this five dozen centers that you have,
mm-hmm.
what is it that causes you to say, boy, those people, they really got it going on over there? That, now, that is exactly the way this center ought to operate. What characteristics would define that?
We would find that every time they gather, which is about 10 times a year, not all of them can make all once a month. There's a meal that they would have about once a month, and there would be new people coming. One or two new blind people coming each time. And as these new people come, they're a little uncertain and unsure, but those who are there say, well, I'm glad you came, and my name is Carrie, and how you doing, so what's life like for you, and can I help you in any way? We would want to be connecting with people who are literally falling through the cracks. They're not getting government aid or support. There used to be a lot of programs to help people who are blind, but they just are not existent due to government cutbacks in so many states. And those people then would say, boy, I liked being here. I think I'll come back. And they, in turn, bring other people. That's a good center because it's always connecting with people and helping people who are struggling, first, to feel comfortable about themselves, and then second, comfortable about talking about faith issues. It doesn't mean, boom, they're going to be, wow, I believe in Jesus and I know I'm in heaven now. There isn't always that talk right away.
Do you have centers in St. Louis, in the St. Louis area?
We have two, in fact. The one that is still meeting at Concordia Maplewood has grown so much, we decided we had to branch it off, and so we started a second one up at Salem in Blackjack on the north side.
So if there's a person listening to us right now
mm-hmm.
who is either visually impaired or somebody who has a relative or a close friend who mm-hmm. is visually impaired, and they say, boy, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
What should they do? Should they call you first, or is there a phone number you'd like them, or should they just show up at Concordia Maplewood, or what?
I would suggest calling. Just so we can be ready and prepared and make that first visit a
what number should they
good
use?
One. I would say call our local number and talk to me. Talk to me.
Oh, you can actually reach the executive director.
Yeah, I'm not always there. Like today, I'm not in the office, but I'm always regularly checking voicemail. I get back to people. I try to every day.
Now, when they call, should they call you David or Dave?
Pastor Dave.
Pastor Dave.
Pastor Dave. That actually started when I was a parish pastor. When especially in the school, when I go over to the K through 8 school, and the first graders run up and say, "Hi, Pastor Andra." I just call me Pastor Dave. It was so much easier. That's how it started.
Now, this program that we're on now will be archived. It'll be at KFUO.org, mm-hmm. and it's very possible that somebody in Seattle or Tampa Bay or mm-hmm. Houston, Texas, will hear this. Is there a website that they can check to say, well, I wonder if one of these outreach centers is in my territory?
Yeah, we do have a website. blindmission.org, just written out, blindmission.org, and there then there'll be outreach centers listed, and just click on that and you'll see them. Right now I think we're all caught up on what's open for outreach centers that's on our website. Sometimes there's a little bit of a delay because we have a volunteer webmaster. And he does it in his part-time.
Yeah. All right, let me change directions here
mm-hmm.
and go to the life section of USA Today for February 3rd. There is a story on page 8, kind of buried in the back. It shows a photograph of people in Haiti who are attaching black ribbons to a cross during a ceremony on Monday at a mass grave in something called Titanen. I guess that's the way I would pronounce it, Titanen, just outside Port-au-Prince. The headline is Taking Dignity Out of Death. Subhead, Mass Graves for Earthquake Victims Rob Haitians of Spiritual Connections. Kathy Lynn Grossman of USA Today wrote the article, and she says, for survivors of the earthquake in Haiti, one horror may linger a lifetime. Many will never know for certain if or where their loved ones are buried in the mass graves around Port-au-Prince. The estimate of deaths are near 200,000. And the Haitian government says it has buried more than 150,000 people, few of them with documentation. But the spiritual and psychological effect of these graves will linger, according to Professor of Anthropology Karen Richman of the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. She has family in Haiti who survived the quake. For Haitians in particular, the mass graves are wrenching. Richman says Haitians place significant emphasis on dying with dignity and holding a funeral, a process that can take up to 9 days. Relationships with the dead last forever. Survivors believe their ancestors visit them in their dreams and give them guidance. Here's a quote. Every culture has its way of making sense of the beginning and end of life. Our rituals are the way we control what these events mean to us. Irish wakes, Jews say the Kaddish prayer, Hindu processions, she says. As you listen to this story from your background as a parish pastor, can you speak to the implications, the cultural, first of all, the cultural implications of dignifying the process of dying and burying people?
Wow. There's so many ways to go with this. First, I was caught with that phrase, rituals are the way we control things in life. That is very, very true. The dilemma is so often we don't have the ability, the time, the effort, or the chance to have the ritual, and so it feels out of our control. And that's what people really struggle with, when it's out of our control. I'm making some assumptions here, and so if more information came out, I would maybe have to backtrack slightly. It sounds as though, especially when it indicated that their ancestors visit them in dreams, there is a what we often term the ancient animistic religions, and I know that it is alive and fairly well alive in Haiti. I don't know how many of the people do practice it, that believe that literally people from the ancestral world will communicate with you and they'll give you good guidance and help you in making decisions in this world so that you can get into the best place of the afterworld. That is very foreign and far from the Christian faith. And so that's where I'm put at a dilemma in commenting on this. So let's start there by saying that's not a common practice or understanding for us who are Christian.
The article says, to perhaps add some clarity to the issue that you're describing, although the Catholic Church frowns on voodoo culture, it is pervasive in Haiti, where many are buried with both Catholic and voodoo rites. Richmond says, every family inherits the spirits their ancestors worshipped. You need to communicate with the ancestors to reach these spirits or souls. You need to know they have been respected. And thereupon is the issue here, that if you're burying people with bulldozers, and I've seen some of the video, and they're just using bulldozers to clear rubble, and there are people in the rubble, and they are put in these huge mass graves, that's not very respectful and it's not very dignified. So how would you differentiate voodoo burial and communicating with spirits and respecting spirits and ancestors from the process of Christian burial?
Yeah, and I made the comment, and I appreciate your reading on about the voodoo religion, and we hear that, and I remember growing up in the 60s and watching, I remember Gilligan's Isle in particular dealt with voodoo from the tribes around them and other islands, and there's other shows that did it too, and it brings the idea that we contact our ancestors and they contact us. And well, actually this all came from Africa, and it's very strong in Africa especially. And I'm going to answer your question eventually here, Chuck. Can I call you Chuck, by the way?
Yes, you may.
Okay. Didn't know if I had to go with Charles. Talking about first names.
I don't think anybody goes with Charles.
Okay. And one of the dilemmas that, even as you read it the first time, I went, oh my gosh. I was asked to go over in 1993 to speak to blind Christians in Ghana, Africa. And I was asked to go because the missionary said, they keep telling me that I, as the missionary, don't understand what they're struggling and going through. And as I, when I went, and as I listened to their story, they were bringing into the Christianity some of the ancient animistic beliefs. And one of them is that when the ancestors detect somebody who's not a good person or a bad person, somebody who is a bad influence in this world, the ancestors will mark them so they're clearly identified and you stay away from them. And what are some of those markings? Blindness, deafness, paraplegic. So anyone that was physically different, they were believed, marked by the ancestors as a bad person, a cursed person, cursed by the ancestors. And so the blind people in Ghana were living and struggling with this. And I pointed out to them that Jesus took the curse and the punishment when he died on the cross. You're forgiven. We're not talking about punishment anymore. And so these things of blindness and deafness or paraplegic or whatever the physical difference is, they no longer are anything in that realm, but they can be used by God and become a blessing. They were shocked at how can it be a blessing, because we knew it as a curse. And I talked to them how they can use that connection with others to share the gospel, because missionaries can't get to the rest of the blind people. They're hidden in back huts. Now, that's a ramble. To come back to your point and question here, I think we need to differentiate between the religious aspect of death and burial and then just human dignity. But then I suppose there's a third factor of public health, and I would assume that's why they're using the bulldozers, is if they don't bury these bodies soon, they will start to decay, and that will bring insects, which will bring diseases, and then they'll have an even worse mess on their hands than they even do now. That's a dilemma, and I'm not sure I have easy answers for that one.
So, as a visually impaired person,
mm-hmm.
do you suffer indignity? Do blind people suffer indignity from time to time?
Oh, lots of times.
Lots of times?
Yeah. People
such
often,
as, can you give me an example?
Sure. I do a lot of travel, and so as I move through airports, many times I feel as though they're treating me like a piece of luggage. Well, take him over there. And they'll continue to talk with the person who's guiding me, which is usually a sky cap or someone by the airport. They never even talk to me. They don't hand me my ticket, and now I interrupt and say, excuse me, you need to deal with me. I'm the person who's traveling. Where do you want me to go? And I force them to do that. Restaurants, when we're sitting down, if all of a sudden the waiter or waitress realizes I'm blind, they'll turn to my wife. Well, what does he want? And my wife is pretty good. I don't know, you better ask him, and you better be nice to him, because he's going to be paying the bill. But people, they don't know what to do, and so they treat people with disabilities as though they don't even exist. At least that's how it feels when you have the disability.
Well, do you remember when Katrina hit? My memory is that there were bodies.
Mm-hmm.
There were people who drowned.
Yeah.
There were bodies in the water.
Yeah.
And, of course, there were many distressed people who couldn't find loved ones. And I suppose that perhaps there were some bodies that were never recovered. I don't know, but it's not necessarily Haiti.
Right.
I mean, it can happen here in the United States. We have tornadoes and hurricanes and floods. When somebody loses a loved one and there's no body to bury, how do you handle that as a pastor?
Yeah.
I mean, the grief is even more pronounced, is it not?
It can be. And that's why I commented about the rituals we perform to control our life. And that is one of them, is we need closure. When a person dies, we need to acknowledge to ourselves some way, somehow, they no longer will be interacting with us. And that's why Christians have a funeral rite, and it's to say they no longer are with us. Now, as Christians, we say they're with Jesus, and Jesus has their soul, and the soul will be reunited to the body. All of that is to bring that closure so that we can say they are truly gone and that they no longer will be part of our life. When one does not have that opportunity, the mourning, that's M-O-U-R, the crying, can continue to happen because there was that no closure, that finality. And so as a pastor, I would make every effort to determine whether that person truly would be, is no longer alive. And if so, then I would suggest to that parishioner, let's have a funeral service. Let's have that rite of closure and trust that God has taken care of that person, and if a Christian, they're in his hands.
So as a person who has suffered indignity probably more than the rest of us because of your blindness, does that create in you an extra sensitivity to this situation? Do the two things link up?
Oddly enough, they do. And you're very perceptive in observing that. I felt very much akin for those people because of the lack of dignity that they are experiencing. And usually when a chaplain is there, and I know there are many chaplains there and pastors serving and helping them, they will try to make connection on that level to say, hey, I'm with you. I understand to a degree, not everything you're going through, but it's an indignity that we wish no one would have. And so may I help you from this point to have some dignity and closure.
You know, probably, I guess, the most obvious example of this situation is 9/11.
Yeah.
And all the people who perished in the rubble of the Twin Towers.
Mm-hmm.
And virtually nobody recovered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they worked so hard to try to find bodies early and did not. And it would appear that many of those people were just obliterated.
That's right.
There was nothing found of thousands of people.
There was the bombing in Oklahoma City in
95,
was it?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something, do you think, that you get over after it's been almost 8-9 years now since 9/11 or 1995, even longer? Do you get over that indignity, Pastor, or do you think that the fact that you did not get a chance to have that closure and bury your loved one stays with you forever or in this life?
That varies from person to person. I know some people who had the person just, my wife's grandmother and grandfather, he died of a heart attack at age 65, and to her dying death, the grandmother, Emma, she mourned and cried about him every single day. There was a funeral, there was the rite of closure, but she couldn't get over it.
Couldn't get over it.
So it really depends on the person,
right,
and I think where they are in relationship to God and themselves.
Let me take this bottom of the hour break. You're listening to the Bible Study, Ask the Pastor, and we'll be right back.
Wednesday's Essence in the Afternoon will include a conversation of interest to you, especially if you're one of the approximately 65 million caregivers in the United States today. Anita Dellinger wants you to know that you are not alone. She has co-authored Blessings and Prayers for Caregivers and will be giving away a couple of copies courtesy of Concordia Publishing House. I'm Diane Summers. The Essence is from 1 to 4 p.m. Wednesday on KFUO Radio. We are where you are.
A revolution rampages outside while a family huddles inside.
When is the fighting going to end?
I don't know, son.
Sounds like they're getting closer.
Tonight, the life of Jack and his family will change forever.
Seize the Baron!
Please! Please don't take him! Please!
Lightlighter Theater presents The Unexpected Returns on the next Lightlighter Theater.
Saturday mornings at 11 on KFUO Radio.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Move over, global warming. There's a real crisis coming our way. For the first time in the not-too-distant future, the number of the world's elderly will outnumber children. The United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs says the gloomy prediction will come to pass by 2045. Experts are predicting a demographic winter that could be the biggest international crisis of the century. Abortion has caused the elderly population to rise three times faster than the world's overall population. Nations around the globe are killing millions of preborn children, and it's gradually catching up with us. In some countries, there are more abortions than live births. This demographic winter will affect every aspect of our lives. Ultimately, man will reap what he sows.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.
Questioning. I'm Steve Coleman with today's Religion Roundup. A group of U.S. Baptist missionaries arrested trying to leave Haiti with a busload of children they gathered from the disaster zone have been questioned by a Haitian judge. The investigating magistrate queried the five women for several hours Tuesday and will follow up with the five men today. That's according to Haiti's communications minister, who says the evidence will help a prosecutor decide whether to file charges. No lawyers were present for Tuesday's questioning. The Baptists say they were trying to help orphans after the earthquake, but Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton's chief of staff, Cheryl Mills, says they should have been.
Making sure that they already had been adjudicated to be orphans, because in any other instance, you truly don't know whether or not you were separating a family or not.
The director of Haiti's Social Welfare Agency says the Americans apparently enlisted a clergyman who went knocking on doors asking people if they wanted to give away their children. I'm Steve Coleman.
Hi, I'm Mark Hawkinson, host of Jubilation on Sunday afternoons. Please consider these words from Jesus. He who believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water. A water that will well up to everlasting life, I might add. I invite you to join me for Living Songs that will well joy up in your heart. That's Jubilation this Sunday from 1 to 4 p.m. right here on KFUO Radio.
Join Harbinger for their new CD release concert, Reach Out. Friday, February 12th, doors open at 7, concerts at 8 p.m. at the main sanctuary of St. John Lutheran Church, Ellisville.
Seasons will come and go.
Spread the word about Harbinger's CD release concert featuring music from their new CD, Reach Out.
I have been crucified with Christ.
Harbinger in concert, Friday, February 12th, St. John Lutheran Church, Ellisville.
If you'd like to join us here on our conversation with Pastor Dave Andrus, Executive Director of Lutheran Blind Mission, I'm Chuck Rathert. I'm going to change the subject here, Pastor Andrus, okay, if you don't mind, and bring to your attention a story from Oregon City, Oregon, where a couple has been found guilty of criminally negligent homicide for praying over their ill teenage son instead of seeking medical help. The jury returned the verdict Tuesday on the second day of deliberations in the trial of Jeff and Marcy Beegley. They are both members of the Followers of Christ Church in Oregon City. The couple is scheduled for sentencing on February 18th. Prosecutors say the Beegleys had a duty as parents to provide medical care for their 16-year-old son, Neil, who died in 2008 of complications from a urinary tract blockage. The defense argued the teenager had symptoms more like a cold or the flu. From time to time, people who have a kind of religious zeal for the miraculous or some kind of contempt for ordinary, traditional, worldly medical approach go down this path. In this case, it ended the life of 16-year-old Neil Bigley. As a pastor, how do you evaluate this situation? Was this couple simply trying to be faithful beyond the rest of us, to exhibit a faith that most of the rest of us are incapable, or are they guilty of a crime?
And actually, there's a similar case going on in my hometown of Wausau, Wisconsin. And my mother keeps sending me clippings of what's going on. And so I've had some time to think about this question. Assuming it is as you're relating, I am concerned with that ruling, because that ruling did exercise the fact that they aren't free to exercise their faith or religion. I may not agree with their faith or religion, but if that is taken away, those who live in Oregon could face other problems, even for those who are Christian. But here, the other dilemma you have, and you need to be aware of, is, does the state have any laws relating to this? And the laws, really, the jury is guided to make a determination on not what they think, but on what the law states, and to whether that person or persons accused of breaking the law broke the law. And so the law itself may be the problem there. And if a person is not permitted to exercise their faith and their religion because the law states such, yeah, I see that as a problem, because it's taken away our freedom of religion held by the Constitution.
But somebody died.
Yep.
I'm struggling for a comparable example in my own life. I don't have one.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that if the exercise of your religion results in the unnecessary death of somebody else, that's a problem, isn't it?
It could be.
For example, I hope this isn't offensive to you. I don't mean it to be.
Go ahead.
But you've told your story here on our program before. Mm-hmm. You were not born blind.
Correct.
You were sighted for a period of time in your youth.
11 years.
11
right.
years, your eyesight deteriorated,
mm-hmm.
and you've never had it since.
Right.
If there had been a treatment as simple as the treatments we have for urinary tract infections available to your parents, which would have prevented losing your sight,
mm-hmm.
but instead of taking you to the doctor or following a fairly simple medical procedure, they prayed over you and
mm-hmm.
you lost your sight,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't you resent that?
Well, I can answer your question, but you're putting me into a wrong corner.
Uh-oh. Well, that's never fair.
Well, you're mixing here, to choose one of the other radio people, law and gospel, mixing church and state together. Yes, I probably would resent it. And wished they would have done that if that were the case. Yet at the same time, if the law steps in and says you cannot exercise your faith in this way, it's all of a sudden the state is exercising over the church, mandating what it can and cannot do. And even during Prohibition, when alcohol was forbidden by law, they still permitted churches to have wine so they could have communion.
Well, the state does say, we don't care if you're a Mormon or not. If you want to have 10 wives, we're not going to allow that. The state says that.
Huh, that's an interesting one. You know that's for true in Utah?
You make a good point that the analogy that I made up there
mm-hmm.
did not include arresting your parents
mm-hmm.
for failing to get the in the hypothesis there, the thing that I just created out of thin air, the help that you would have needed, which
right.
could have saved your sight. Well, I didn't include that. I'm not sure that they should be arrested for that either.
Right.
But I do think that if life can be preserved, if it can be protected, it ought to be protected. I don't think people should be dying from urinary tracts because parents are exercising their faith. I guess that's my simple view of it.
Yeah. Yet if we do that, then we're saying the state can step in and stop the practice of religion.
Well, there's another, of course, and we've heard this before, there are some faiths that believe that it is unbiblical to accept a blood transfusion.
Uh-huh.
And if a blood transfusion is refused and a death occurs,
mm-hmm.
you think that's okay?
It's not something I would do, but I do appreciate and uphold in our Constitution the freedom of religion. And so if people make that choice, I will grant them that choice based under the Constitution. But not only under the Constitution, it's a protection for us as Lutherans or whatever faith you may be. Because if you have the state stepping in and saying, you can't do this, even though your religion says you can, we'll be having the federal government judges stepping in and running our lives.
There was a story that we dealt with here on Ask the Pastor here just a few days ago
okay.
where a man in Colorado has been arrested. He is a pot user, and he is making the claim that his religion, that smoking marijuana is the sacrament in his religion. Therefore, he should be allowed to smoke pot as part of his religious experience. Now, that would be against the law.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you think he should be, since that's his faith, that he should be allowed to smoke pot?
I think the courts have the right, or the government, I'll say it that way, has the right to evaluate, is this truly a religious right, or did this man make up the religion just to get around the laws so he can smoke his pot? And if he makes up the religion just to so he can smoke his pot, then no. But if it truly is part of the ritual of the religion, then yes, under religious circumstances, then he should be able to. And I point back to all the churches who had wine for communion during Prohibition. It's the same type of thing.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Hi, Miss Harris. You're on the Bible study.
Oh, hi. I just want to go back a little ways to the conversation you were having before about the Haitian people.
Sure.
And their religious practices. I just kind of feel like this is not the time to really be making comparisons about situations. My heart goes out to the Haitian people. I'm praying for them and with them. And I know you were talking about an anthropologist. You were quoting an anthropologist. I feel a connection with the Haitian people because Catherine Dunham, she was an anthropologist, and she was located here in East St. Louis in Illinois, and she gave her life and pretty much all of her money to help the Haitian people before the earthquake. And I just really think that we probably should be concentrating more on just helping and praying right now.
All right, thanks for the call. Pastor, any comments?
The one thought I have, and I didn't mention it earlier, and I think this at first I agree with her. We really need to focus most of our energies on helping people. Yet the dilemma, and I think this would be one of the reasons it is a good point of discussion, is do we really know what's best for them? For years, we thought going in and giving our Western culture and religion in Africa was the right thing to do. Well, now we realize, no, as missionaries, sometimes we overstepped our bounds and gave them Western culture and not Christianity. And that would be the question. As we go in and help the Haitians, are we doing an injustice at the same time because we think we know what they want? And the more applicable situation, and I think of, and this goes back to the indignity of the huge mass burial, there's been many times I've stood on the curb waiting to cross the street and someone says, let me help you across, and they grab my arm and start pushing me across. And yet, I've two things. One, I usually stiff-arm them and say, shall we wait for the traffic? They're so focused on helping me, they don't even pay attention to the cars. But secondly, I might not want anybody to go across. Maybe I'm waiting for the bus there. We can't just assume we know what's best. I think we do need to be aware of many aspects, and that's where I think the gal makes a good point. We need to be aware of anthropologically what the people are thinking and provide help that is helpful and not just a quick fix. And so the mass graves is a quick fix, but it might be doing more harm in the long run. But I, flipping back then, I think a lot of that's due to the government, and the government needs to properly direct and guide the help that's coming in. And to be honest, I have heard no comment, and they might be doing a great job, but I've heard no comment on the government of Haiti and what they are doing to help orchestrate recovery.
All right, let's. Can we turn the page here? I'd like to tackle something a little bit lighter.
Okay.
And I want to ask you: are you following the Super Bowl hoopla, Pastor? Do you have
a little bit? Oh, I love football.
You love football?
Yeah, I do.
I'm going to guess that you are pulling for the Saints, since you are a Christian pastor and that you have a Christian ministry, and therefore, obviously, you would have to be for the Saints, am I right?
Well, which Saints are we talking about? The Voodoo Saints down on Bourbon Street?
No, we're talking about the New Orleans Saints.
I'm kind of neutral at this one. I'm just looking forward and hope it's a great high-scoring game.
Well, you know,
since my Packers aren't in there, I can be neutral.
Ah, a Packer fan in mourning. Well, the... you know, we seem to work so hard these days to keep religion separate from the state and
mm-hmm.
maybe even from a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
We have this drive to be secular, but the Associated Press is reporting today a story that says faith, hope, prayer, abiding love in synagogues and churches. The
mm-hmm.
traditional message and prayers are flavored by the New Orleans Saints' march to the Super Bowl down there in New Orleans. Transcending, which is a good spiritual word, transcending spiritual differences. Now, you know, there have been all kinds of seminars and conclaves and confabs and everything else taking people of opposing religious viewpoints and trying to build bridges and come together that just haven't worked at all, Pastor.
Mm-hmm.
But the Super Bowl is getting it done. All of a sudden, the Christians and the Jewish folks down in New Orleans are transcending their spiritual differences, and they are all being bound under the umbrella of the rousing Who Dat cheer. Local churches are scurrying to change Sunday service schedules to avoid conflict with this Sunday's Super Bowl. Rabbi Robert Lowy has taught the Who Dat cheer in Hebrew to his congregation.
Oh my.
There is even a voodoo priestess that they have found who is pulling for the Saints. This is all good, isn't it, Pastor?
Well, this happened in Wisconsin long before the Saints took their march to the Super Bowl, that churches up there will will guide and change their times depending upon the Packer games.
I'm shocked.
the question is, who's God going to cheer for?
Well, do you have the answer to that question?
Well, yes, I do, actually. I really do.
I'm anxious to hear it.
First off, I got to point out, just as many prayers are going up on the Saints side, there's going to be equal amount of prayers going up on the Colts side. And then I'm reminded of a story back in 2 Kings chapter 6 about a... do we have time for this quick story? I'll make it quick if so.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
That the king of the Arameans is saying, all right, who of you is giving away our war plans? Because every time we go to attack the Israelites, they know we're coming. And one of the commanders says, well, it's not any of us, but it's the prophet in that region that's always telling the king where we are. Well, then go find this prophet. And he sends a big army contingency, and the servant of God comes out and goes, oh, my gosh, my Lord, we're in trouble. And Elijah says, open his eyes, Lord, so he may see the true army. And he opens his eyes, the Lord does, and he sees the chariots of fire around the mountain. And then Elijah prays, blind them. That's not physical blindness like me, but blindness of perceiving that he is the guy they're looking for. And he says, who are you looking for? Well, Elijah, well, follow me. So Elijah brings them to the city, the capital city of Samaria. Now, from a long way away, the watchman on the tower probably says, we've got a hostage situation, because he would have recognized Elisha's robes out front, thinking the army had captured him. And then when Elisha gets up close and says, open the gates for my friends, and then the guards would have laughed and said, he's got them, and the inside they are. And then Elisha prays, now open their eyes. And they see that they're in the city of Samaria, and they're in trouble. And then the king of Israel, it says, shall I kill them, my father? Shall I kill them? And it repeats it twice, just like that. You can almost see his glee. Shall I kill them? Shall I kill them? And Elisha says, no, you don't kill prisoners of wars. Feed them. Treat them with nicety. And my comment to all of this is, Elijah points out, God is not on any side except for the side of mercy.
That's I don't think the Saints are going to be showing the Colts any mercy and
well,
vice versa.
Then he's on neither side.
So when the Saints fans, the fervent Saints fans,
uh-huh.
and the fervent Colt fans,
uh-huh.
some of whom are pastors, I know.
I'm sure.
Are offering up prayers on behalf of their team. Now, the pastors aren't probably doing that, but maybe some of their parishioners are.
Right.
Does he get a little irritated with that? Does he say to himself, these people, they're praying for their football teams, and we've got huge devastation down in Haiti. Maybe they ought to be praying for people in Haiti. Does that irritate God, you think?
I do think he kind of, so to speak, figuratively drums his fingers on the table. When will they get it? When will they get it? And he gladly hears the prayers of our children, of his children. Doesn't always answer the prayers of his children, just like I don't always answer my kids with what they ask for specifically, but I hear the point behind that prayer or the request of my kids, so I'll try to meet that. And I think the Father in heaven does hear the intent of our prayers. How he'll answer that, that's beyond me. But I think you do make a good point that God sometimes, when we pray, kind of drums his finger, when will they get it? And many times he'll answer prayers in specific ways, even sometimes to do a miracle, so that maybe we'll have his attention and that we'll get really what he's trying to do.
Well, the way this little story wraps up here, I find interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Last paragraph says, the outpouring reflects the Saints' 43 years in the NFL wilderness. You'll notice the near connection to 43 years before making it to the promised land of the Super Bowl. Now, you may not have known this, but the franchise was awarded on All Saints Day back in 1966.
Oh, my goodness.
And the name is associated with a Christian hymn, which is, you probably know this, When the Saints Go Marching In.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think about this slightly tongue-in-cheek biblical overlap with the Super Bowl that they're doing down there at the Associated Press. Is that all appropriate, or do you think that we've had some kind of church-state violation?
Well, I don't know about church-state violation, but we certainly have had a confusion and lack of understanding of what faith is about.
How so?
Again, it goes back to how does God answer the prayers when you've got prayers coming up on both sides and something that has nothing to do with life and salvation. But yet our God, give us this day our daily bread, gives us all that we need, and part of what we need is recreation and fun. And so he does provide good things to us here on an earthly basis. But to go further and push it to all that imagery, I think goes a little bit too far.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Now, that's not to say we didn't have Super Bowl parties at my church in the fellowship hall.
Well, I was
going
to say, you might have pastors scrambling to rewrite their sermons right now.
And we did split up the side of the fellowship hall, saying, which side are you on? And we sat on different sides. But we all shared from the food that we brought in the potluck. There's some fun and jest, but yet we can't go too far with that.
So I didn't catch it. Do you have a favorite in the Super Bowl? Do you have a pick for us?
Do I have a favorite? You're really putting me on the spot, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm asking you to come right on the record here. Colts or Saints? What's it going to be?
I'm looking forward to a very good game. I, you know, the people say the Colts are a little bit favored, and I think they tend to have a little bit stronger chance, but I think equally the Saints are showing enough that they could win. I really am, out of all Super Bowls, this one's a real close toss-up. I really think so. I really do.
The I guess it would be a theology of glory then to come to the conclusion that God would be on the side of the Saints.
I think so.
And it would be a bit of a theology of glory to think that God might intervene in some divine way. I mean, you know, you realize, of course, that if some miraculous thing happens and the Saints win, we're all going to have to wonder if God intervened.
Oh, boy.
I'm sorry. I'm pulling your leg a little bit too much.
You are. That's
Thank you
okay.
so much for the conversation. God's blessings to your work with Lutheran Blind Mission, and we hope that you'll be richly blessed in the opening of your new centers.
Thank you.
What's that website again if somebody wants to find a center?
Blindmission.org. And our toll-free number is 888-215-2455.
Thank you, Pastor.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you. Pastor Dave Andrus, Executive Director of Lutheran Blind Mission, here on our Ask the Pastor program. Tomorrow we continue in the book of Numbers. We're about halfway through, I think. We will take up chapter 21 in Numbers. I think Pastor Berglund gave us a hint there about the snake on a pole story coming up next time. Pastor Curtis Dieterding of Trinity Lutheran Church in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, probably pretty cold up there, we'll talk to him next time. And our Ask the Pastor guest here on our Bible study program will be our good friend from Macungie, Pennsylvania, Concordia Lutheran Church, Pastor Waldemar Vanovskis. Thanks for listening.
Listen to Chuck Ratherton guests Monday through Friday at the same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of The Bible Study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible Study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.